wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Hello, Joel. How are we doing today?
Kia ora. I am awesome. And you know why? Bird of the Year voting has opened.
That's right. So, you know, don't forget about that, because this is an important part of our democracy. I know we put out a lot of warnings for the local body elections, but this is serious here.
This is what actually matters. So I got to ask, who are you backing this year?
Well, here at the station, our official stance is the karere, which is a falcon, and apparently cannibalistic, which we've been told. I don't know how accurate that is, but we do have a station duty to say that. Just a disclaimer.
Well, I'm going to tell you who I'm backing this year, and that is the kuaka.
The kuaka.
The kuaka, also known as the godwit, who has the longest flight of any bird in the world, travels from Alaska to New Zealand every year. Longest flight has been over 8 days. No stopping for food, no stopping for sleep, no stopping for anything. God. The kuaka.
I don't know if I've ever done anything for 8 days in a row.
I mean, you probably lived.
Lived, yeah, the bare minimum, but yeah, not making a journey for 8 days straight without stopping.
Although sometimes it feels like it. All right, let's talk about some science here. We got, now that we're all excited about Bird of the Year, let's talk about birdsong. There was a recent paper where they actually just let people listen to birdsong for 6 minutes versus listening to urban traffic setting, and found that listening to birdsong is good for the old noggin. Mm. Improvements in anxiety and paranoia after listening to just 6 minutes of birds doing their thing versus people that are listening to urban traffic actually showed more signs of depression.
Mm. I guess living in town, having to listen to cars beeping at each other, can't be good for you.
No, probably a little stressful.
Mm. I wonder if that would change if we knew what the birds were saying.
Yes. Yes. What do birds say? We don't exactly know.
But crazy.
That's a whole nother dear science topic. But the idea is that nature is good for us, because there was also another study that came out recently that said that people that spend an hour just walking in nature versus an hour walking in an urban area had less stress and fear. And so this time they're able to do like an MRI on these people's brains before and after, and saw that their amygdala, which is the part of the brain that controls stress and fear, so like climbers, people that do free solo, like Alex Holland, if you've ever seen that movie Free Solo, his amygdala actually doesn't activate at all, meaning that quantifiably, he does not have fear.
Well, that would explain a lot.
Right. But again, another dear science topic. That was the part of the brain that they were actually looking at in this study, and found that people that were spent an hour just walking out in nature, less activation of the amygdala, meaning less stress and fear.
Do we know if this would work with like fake birdsong? So could we replace like, you know, the cars honking noises with, you know, some bird cry?
In theory, yes. So that's what they did, is they actually had a CD, played it for 6 minutes, doesn't matter where you are, but just what they're proposing is the exposure to this nature sound, and birds, gotta love our birds, is what's doing the trick here.
I feel like just the general ambiance, if you will, of birds just singing is quite nice, but also like, this might not apply to all birds. Like, if one was just shrieking by your ear, like if you heard a magpie.
True. I've been to Australia. It's terrible there.
They're like just dive bombing you. I can't imagine that is anxiety relieving.
Right. There could be a lot of different confounding factors and biases in this study. But the idea is, along with this nature walk study, is that it appears green is good.
It is. It's good to have some actual science backing that up, rather than just someone saying, "Hey, go for a walk."
Right. More research is needed. So, anyone thinking about taking any walks this summer, some hikes in the bush, science has your back.
Wow. There you go.
All right. Well, let's talk some more brain stuff, because we're getting into the brains here, and some researchers in Australia in a completely different study, have done something a bit funky. Now, are either of you gamers?
No.
No, I don't think so.
No, neither of us will admit it on air, but we're here and our official stance is no.
Okay. Are you familiar with the game Pong?
Yes.
Yes, where you have the two sides and the ball bounces back and forth. You basically try to score
a goal. It's really hard.
It's...
Maybe for you.
It's a game, all right. Well, anyway, what scientists did is they got real nerdy and they wanted to play some Pong, so they grew a brain in a lab, like in a dish, and taught it to play Pong.
Stop it. Okay, what are the logistics here? I have so many questions.
Was that the first thing they taught it to do?
Well, they wanted to test how well it could react to external stimuli.
Right.
So it's the first time they've ever been able to connect it to something like that. And they said, well, why not Pong? It's simple, straightforward. We can see if we can teach it to play. And it learned the game within 5 minutes.
Wow. Was it good?
No, it was awful. But better than random chance.
Right.
So there's still room for improvement, but it was a step forward.
Mm. I feel like you probably benefit from having arms as opposed to just being a brain in a dish, but... this is really interesting.
Right, so it was basically just giving it electrical signals at different frequencies, because that's what your brain is. It's a connection of neurons, and they just fire in different electrical signals. So they were able to manipulate that and actually have this tiny brain. So it's not like a full brain. This is something that is like the size of a bumblebee, maybe.
Right.
But they're able to connect it to these electrodes, and... The way that it worked is that if it missed the ball in Pong, it would give it a random signal. And biologically, we don't like randomness. We want things that are predictable. So every time it made a save, it gave it a predictable response. And it found that it would eventually make enough moves to get that predictable response.
Oh my gosh.
So do we have any idea of what they could do next? Given, you know, if this is successful, where do you go from here?
So the researchers, the first thing they're going to do once they make this brain is they're going to get it drunk. You think I'm joking.
All that stress from playing Pong.
Yeah. So they're going to give it alcohol and see how that impairs how the brain works. So what they're trying to do is to create something where you can actually like test drugs and see how they work without, you know, doing animal studies or something that is like an organoid like a human brain, so they might get better treatments out of it.
Got a bit of feedback there.
Sorry, that sounds horrendous. But yeah, well, I guess getting a brain drunk as opposed to just getting teenagers drunk or your typical uni students would probably be a better option.
That is the concept, yes. And it is really interesting. Now, we're not talking about a fully sentient brain that knows it's a brain yet. Mm. So there are obviously ethical questions that need to be addressed before you go and start making what is our intelligence in the lab. But we're getting places when it comes to science, always pushing the boundaries.
Yeah, and maybe the brain will enjoy a bit of vodka as opposed to tequila. Yes, that's
a completely different study, Christina. Again, we'll try to stay on topic here. All right, one final amazing story that I know you're going to appreciate.
Mm.
And this time we're talking about an archaeological mystery dealing with frogs.
But no longer a mystery. Is that the case?
Well, not really. See, we have some good evidence to suggest that this mystery has been solved. So we're talking frogs here. Frogs, if you didn't know, are actually pretty cool. They've been around since dinosaurs. They lived beside dinosaurs.
Oh my god. I didn't expect them to be from millions of years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know why I thought they were just kind of there.
So what this archaeological study looked at was, or this paleontology, excuse me, is that they looked at 45 million years ago. They had this big, huge mass death of frogs, and they had no idea why. They thought, well, maybe it's because they lived in this pond and the pond dried up, or maybe, well, there's disease or something. And these researchers recently found out it's neither of those.
No way, it was an asteroid.
They are proposing that it was a mass frog orgy that went wrong.
Wow.
If you've been following along in recent weeks, we've had some talk about orgies in terms of dolphins, and this was kind of like a smaller group, but not how mass are we talking here?
So this was, I think they had about 150 specimens. And so what they've actually been able to see these in different locations are these mass graves. And so what they're proposing is that these frogs were getting a little too freaky and they just lost energy to exhaustion and they drowned in the pond.
You would think a mass orgy would be good for the survival of a species, right?
You would think, but there's a limit, apparently, on exactly how much orgy you can do if you're a frog.
Sorry. So you could graph this limit of the physical exertion versus biological benefits.
Correct.
And they have gone past this point.
The point of no return.
They were just far too tired.
And for those taking notes at home on Dare Science health advice, we've got, obviously, go for a walk in the park and listen to the birds and don't, you know, let your orgies get out of bounds, right?
Correct. These are the tenets of this radio program.
And let's kind of go back to this study and how they kind of came to this conclusion. I doubt they used orgy in this scientific report at all.
Mating. Excessive mating.
Oh. And so, yeah, how did they kind of come to this conclusion?
So they looked at the actual fossilized pieces of frog themselves. They found that some of the smaller bones weren't there, which means that they were probably floated away or something. So that means, okay, the pond was still there. They were well preserved. If there wasn't a pond there, if they were just exposed to the atmosphere, they would have decayed way faster. So they're like, all right, the pond was still there. We don't see any evidence for disease, and we know that this can happen with frog and toad species because they live on land, but they go back to these ponds and lakes to mate because they got to create those tadpoles, and this is where things can take a dire turn.
But why might it be that this happened as like a one-off event or, you know, over a certain period of time and doesn't like continue on?
The thing is, they don't believe it is a one-off event. That this is explaining a lot of the mass graves that they are seeing for these different types of species.
Man, animals can get real freaky.
By design.
Wow, again, fantastic.
Take notes at home. There is a limit, an upper bound to the amount of mass animal sex you can have.
Always learning so much here on Dare Science. Thank you, Joel.
Always a pleasure.
Really appreciate it.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.